Okay, are you ready, sir?
Yes, there you go. All right. Thanks so much for agreeing to talk with me, first of all. I wondered if you would start by talking a little bit about your personal background, where you're from originally, and the sort of path you took in becoming in coming to state as a student.
My name is Richard C. Bell, and I lived all of my life in eastern North Carolina, either in Elizabeth City or in Manio. And much of my time was spent on the Outer Banks in Manio, particularly. And there I had a father and a mother who ran a nursery, and my dad designed the amphitheater for the Lost Colony play, and my mother ran the nursery. So my background was perfect for landscape architecture. My father had studied a correspondence course, an international school course, and in landscape architecture, and he persuaded me to go into it at State. I migrated to State because I felt like it was one of the finer institutions to get my learning, and in fact, most of the people that I knew of always went to State because the school was very highly rated, plus it was very inexpensive for us just coming out on the toes of the Depression. I remember my father, with me as the first son coming to State, said to all of us, I won't be able to pay for all of you to go to college, but I can pay for half of you, half of each child. Tuition and so forth, and he was making about $150 a month, which wasn't bad at that time, just after World War II. I graduated in 1945, and I spent 5 years at NC State, first in chemical engineering and then in landscape architecture. Graduated and went to Pittsburgh for my apprenticeship with Simons and Simons, landscape architects. This lasted a year and 3 months, and I won a scholarship to Europe, a fellowship, to spend 2 years in the American Academy in Rome, which allowed me to travel and do whatever I wanted for 2 years, and I worked in trips to 30 countries in all, North Africa, most of the countries of North Africa, all of them in Europe that were not behind the Iron Curtain, and India, Ceylon, Egypt, and Greece.
It's quite a trip.
And then I was ready to start practicing.
Right. And now, as a student, as I understand it, you participated in writing the NC State Master Plan?
No, I worked with Morley J. Williams, and Professor Wall on the background plan for the master plan, and it became the master plan, but I was retained more or less to draw the graphics on it and to work out details. The plan was fairly straightforward. We knew where all the land was, and it was what was then Old Vetville, which was the western part of the campus between where the greenhouses were and Vetville, which was a Veterans like, Village
right.
for veterans who had married right. and come to NC State.
Like the Quonset huts.
Quonset huts. There right. were, and they were... it was an interesting sort of situation to be in as a student because I was very, very interested in urban design and actually by getting into campus planning at an early age, I was able to use urban thinking at the time. Actually, most of our cities in North Carolina were smaller cities and we're not doing much planning, and so you couldn't go to city planning in our cities because there was no bureaucracies to retain you. So that became my way of life for a long time. I worked with most of our emerging universities in the 60s and 70s in particular. That was after NC State became a major university. There was a big hoopla about NC State being University of North Carolina at Raleigh. That was to be their new name, and everything in the University of North Carolina system was to be named that. And most of the emerging universities were. Actually, Western Carolina was able to save its name. Eastern Carolina was able to save its name. Fayetteville State ended up saving its name. Elizabeth City State saved its name. The college in Winston-Salem, A&T, saved its name. The one at NC at Greensboro, A&T, saved its name. So all seven of them actually saved their names by
right.
state leading the fight in the legislature. Out of it came a more liberal way of looking at the university, particularly when Chancellor John T. Caldwell came in, who was a liberal arts doctorate instead of being a professional engineer or a professional agrarian or agricultural dean. He was more interested in a liberal and good-looking campus. So I got retained as a young landscape architect to design the brickyard and do the update to the master plan in 1965.
So that's what you did. You did the update to the master plan. Okay.
Yes.
So you attended the School of Design at a pretty exciting time in its history.
Very exciting.
And I wondered if you could talk about sort of atmosphere at the time.
The atmosphere at the university, really the college at that time, which was about 1947, was that of an aggressive college looking for university status. And so they needed two more schools. And they got School of Design was one of them, and I believe the school. They had already had forestry, agriculture, engineering, and I believe they had one. I'm trying to remember what it was called. I think it was statistics. I think it's statistics, whatever that school was. And so they added design and education, I think. I'm not at all clear on that. But they got the six schools they needed to create a university. Camp Hefner, the first dean we had, came in the winter of 48. That was his first semester. We were on the semester system then, which was three terms instead of two semesters. That came later. But we had three terms, and he came in the winter term and proceeded to turn the school upside down. He first of all, he got architecture out of the mechanical arts school. and then he got the landscape architecture out of the horticultural school, and that was the genesis of the school of the sun, this landscape architecture. Later, of course, you had product design, visual design, and so forth added to the various parts of the school. The dean came from Oklahoma. He was not shy in any sense of the word. He demanded the utmost out of his students, and we worked literally night and day on projects in order to get accreditation in both landscape architecture and architecture. And we were in barracks, army barracks, for a great deal of our classes, and it was just an exciting time because for the first time we had a real school of design and a real competitive dean. And the school, by 1950 when I graduated, let's see, from winter of 48 to spring of 50, they, with no ranking at all, they rose to be in one of the 10 best schools of design in the country. So that was, in less than 2 years, he had focused on getting the accreditations through and getting on with a new school. And he was well thought of on campus. He was very good friends with the textile dean and with the engineering deans, because he was a Bauhaus, Bauhaus being the school in Germany that many of the German professors came to America and to get away from Hitler, and they taught at our university, at our school, I'm sorry, at our college, and they really were willing to spend nights with their students, and they just were a hands-on group of faculty. And if you were interested in being anything at that time, you had a good shot at it, because they were willing to work with you to be anything you wanted to be, as long as you were, as a land-grant university is supposed to do, trying to turn out students to create practices in North Carolina. There was a big hue and cry for representation in the state at the time. As I say, NC State was fighting for recognition. So it all came together, really, in our School of Design. I mean, they were the ones who were backing the arts. They were backing the liberal arts concept. We had incomes. Caldwell, a liberal arts dean and head of the school, head of the college, chancellor.
And what? Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
What do you see as the sort of legacy of the School of Design during this period?
I think we all accomplished what the dean set out. The dean had no children. He and his wife Mabel had no children. And he looked on all of us as his children. I mean, if we practiced and did what he wanted us to do, and he gave us the education to get out there and do it, he felt very responsible for us. He was a very responsible person. He helped us get jobs. I mean, it was not that easy to get a job when you graduated from the School of Design in 1950. I ended up in Pittsburgh.
Right. And what sort of training did you receive in Pittsburgh?
I mean, I worked for a very fine landscape architectural firm, Professor Thurlow, who was head of our department, got me a job with Simons and Simons in Pittsburgh, and we were working on airports, public housing projects, and a great deal of civil engineering was mixed in with landscape architecture. and just churches, residences, schools.
And you talked a little earlier about receiving the Prix de Rome.
Prix de Rome.
Okay. And can you talk some about the process of winning that and what it meant to you, what it meant in terms of shaping your ideas and, you know, your subsequent career and all of that?
Well, I think you have to understand that the Rome Prize was a way for me to get to travel in Europe, which I had been reading about and working with the history of the settlers in North Carolina. And so my background was really in history as well as landscape architecture, the history of landscape architecture. And so they had lowered, after the World War II, they had lowered the age requirements in 1950 to be available to anyone 21 and older. Up till then, it had been 35. You had to be a mature graduate student.
Okay.
And they were looking really for principally graduate students from Harvard, Yale, and so forth. But after World War II, with all the service people coming through and everything, they were more interested in spreading the profession. So they selected, I know why they selected me. They selected me to be a leader in North Carolina, to come back and to promote the Beaux-Arts and Beaux-Arts and the understanding of cultural significance in our cities and towns and so forth. And so they sent me to probably the finest finishing school in the world, which was Rome, which had been founded in 1895. French school was much older than we were. They were 200 years older. They were around 270 years old. And but the Rome Prize was certainly elitist in every sense of the word, because the major fellowships, we had one in landscape architecture, there were two in architecture, there was one in sculpture, there was one in painting. I mean, these are artists. There was one in classical studies and art history and archaeology and just, there were only 10 or 11 who went over there, and when, by the time you had two classes each, you had that each year, so you would have 20 some people at the table, so you could debate your theories on anything you wanted. And so outside of that, whatever you perceived as what you wanted to do to learn, I perceived I wanted to do and had so indicated to my jurors that I wanted to study the religions of the world and find out how they created most of the artistic monuments that became the very artifacts that we studied in art history at NC State. For example, Egypt, the great pyramids and the temples at Luxor in Egypt were all products of the way they practiced their religion. They were death chambers, really, and they were built to withstand time. The same with the Greeks. They were into health and vigor and a new way of looking at life, and they're all their monuments, Parthenon and so forth. Respected Olympia, for example, was in sports, and training their bodies, and then you had every other. You had the Romans coming in just on the edge of Christianity. This is where Jesus was crucified, and the Christians were stoned and beat up in the Colosseum, and lions tore them apart and that sort of thing. That was all part of an educational system too, because this is where Catholicism came out of this. Catholicism was a result of needing some sort of hierarchy to rule the Christians. And you can see what happened when the Protestants broke loose. They needed it more than ever. So Protestants had their own bureaucracies, still do. So it's when you talk about influence or anything that I saw over there, it was all influential by studying King Henry VIII and the Protestant churches in Europe, as well as the Catholic institutions like St. Peter's and the Duomo in Florence. And in India, we traveled there. I wanted to also understand the Hindu and the Muslim artistry forms, which had been arrived from the Arabic influences and their fight with in the 12th century with India. And I mean, if you see the capsule that I put down as my reasons for wanting to go to Europe, you can see why they gave the Praetorium to me at 21, which was the youngest practically in the whole system, one of the youngest in the whole system.
Right, so you talked about how the sort of role religions played in, you know, design. Does it play a role in your own design, or?
Oh, very much.
Okay. Could you talk about
that? Oh, very much. I'm very close to plants and people. My practice was very people-oriented and plant-oriented, and I think that's about as close as you can get to Genesis. So.
Okay.
The genesis of my profession was my style was what I perceived we ought to do.
Right.
Or I ought to influence people to do, as they were my friends. And I felt like I would be able to talk to them.
So one of the creations you're most associated with, obviously, is the Wider Garden. And I wondered if you could talk about the history and significance of that and what it's meant to you as a home and working place, and also as a creation, maybe an embodiment of your design philosophy, whatever.
Well, the Wider Garden was a direct influence of Frank Lloyd Wright. He was a master tactician in teaching design. He was a writer. He was a brilliant designer. He was an artist, furniture designer, stained glass designer. And the things he always said and he promoted was the idea of himself. And yourself had to have a place. And so he created Taliesin East and Taliesin West, so he would have a place in two parts of the country. So I decided early on, since, and I don't mean this disparagingly, but most architects at that time in 1955 were still operating out of loft, cheaper spaces in buildings downtown, and I decided that I wanted a place on a major highway that the people could see me actually building a complex right in front of them. Taliesin East was built in Racine, and it was out of the city limits. I mean, way out. Mine was very close to the city limits of Raleigh.
Right.
And so, in a sense, I remember our first building was built on the traditional foundation of a house. And we built our house on the foundation because it just seemed natural to me to and economically sound to use the foundation. So we built the first house, but it was totally contemporary. And people used to drive in and see us building it and say, what is this, a restaurant out in the country or chicken house? What is it you're building? And so it was always interesting to talk to these people. And so it became our house, and we were way out in the country then. I mean, there was nothing around us for 5 miles. And so as soon as I moved to the country and with my wife and children in 61, we started another office building for an art, for a regional art gallery and my landscape architectural practice. My wife was very sound in art, and so she ran the garden gallery, and I created works around the two buildings for other people to see. So Water Garden was a significant, call it an advertising gimmick, if you will, that's being rough. Water Garden was supposed to be a place that people could see contemporary architecture in a contemporary landscape architectural situation.
And I wonder, too, if you could comment on some of your other works, maybe talk about their conception, their planning, their history, or whatever you wanted to talk about them. So I wanted to ask you first about something I walk past every day on my way to the library. That's the Brickyard. What are your memories of putting that together, I guess, and what was...
The Brickyard, by and large, was my favorite project. Because at the time, the university was under the mandates of the construction, North Carolina Construction Division, State Construction Division, and they had allowed $150,000 for 10 scattered projects on the campus. This was the first landscape architectural monies ever allocated to any of our institutions. And I mean, and they worked out a contract with me to spend the money and to do the design. Well, on these 10 buildings. Average was somewhere around $15,000 a building. So anyway, I studied them for a while and came back to Chancellor Caldwell and said, Chancellor, this is foolish. I said, we've spent Bush monies on bushing up buildings that will be, and 7 of the 10 sites will be improved over the next 8 years, will be made bigger, I mean, and so it's just a total waste of money. And I would recommend to you that we put all the money in one massive project. And he said, where would you put it? I said, I'd put it right in the middle of the campus, right there where the Betville is and all those greenhouses. We'll move all them out. That was part of my master plan anyway. And we'll make that a center for the campus on the north side, which is where the library is, which is where the student center was, which is where the round classroom building is being built. And we'll just make that the urban core of the campus. And then you've got the north-south walkways through agriculture, textiles, engineering, you know, all one time, and design for the 6 of the major schools. We're all on the north side of the campus, basically, and living was on the south side. So he said, that's a good idea. Go ahead. So I drew it up and took it down to State Construction. Well, they wouldn't hear that. They didn't want to change the monies. And so Caldwell stepped up and said, well, he reread what, who could command the monies allocated to project. And he discovered that the chancellor of each institution could take charge of the monies and decide how to spend them on the campus. So he took the $150,000 and proceeded to authorize me to go ahead and build it. Well, we got two bids. We lowered the middle terrace 2 feet on the Ryan building because the Brown building, classroom building, looked like a pie on a surface. I mean, it had no foundation or anything. Here was this tremendous round building and just flat on the ground. Mm-hmm. So we lowered them, and we're able to do this. We had to lower certain utility systems, but that's no show, so we lowered that. So we'd end up with a plateau on the east end, a middle plateau for a gathering area, much like a forum in Rome or a major plaza in Madrid or someplace. And the lower plaza, which we never had money to complete in the first stage, so we did the best we could, and we ended up with no trees, no landscaping, no nothing on a landscaping project. Well, of course, landscaping was synonymous at the time with bush planting. I mean, a tree, a shrub, and a bush was the way it was, you know, everything in the country, in the state, as well as the country, was represented by a tree, a bush, and a shrub, and a vine. So anyway, and I said to him, I said, this will be also our major project, because Carolina has its well, it's a great symbol of, God knows what it is, symbol of learning, I guess. And ours will be a symbol of urban design and the fact that you recognize that the campus needs this kind of, and we made the design to incorporate art in it. Well, you've seen this. It's taken 40 years to ever get any art in it, but it was designed as a park with sculptures, all kinds of sculptures, and to be chosen by the chancellor and student representatives and all that sort of thing. So that's what he did, and we took two bids, and the bids ran $300,000 apiece for a $150,000 project. So I went out and requested all brick companies in the state, and we were the number one brick company. Still are, I think, the number one brick state, to donate red bricks. And so they all agreed, all of them, as a brick manufacturing system, agreed to furnish all of the bricks. Were substantial, some 800,000 or 900,000 of them. We had to buy the white bricks from South Carolina because none of our brick companies made white bricks. And so the stripes and everything that really made the design, I think, was done so We laid all of them in sand so they could be lifted and set aside, and the pattern, if you had to get in there and work on electrical lines, and the middle campus was just full of steam tunnels and everything else, you could lift the bricks up, set them aside, and then put them right back in a stylized system that was designed for the brick. And so it was a very interesting design. We designed the curvilinear forms and the various parts to save big trees, and also to set up a kind of a looser feeling. Yes, this is a place where you can all gather, but You can sit on walls and you can do whatever you want. We don't care, you know. You just...
Right.
You look out of front of the student center and look at it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was never made to be a formal advertising of the an engineering mentality, you know. It was set off as of students. Mm-hmm. And when they named it the Brickyard, as far as I'm concerned, they hit it far better than we did. Charles Caldwell wanted to name it the University Plaza, and that's what it was named.
Okay. So the Brickyard was just something that sort of emerged organically?
Came with the students.
Oh, okay.
Because that's the first time they never had any brick walks or anything. They had a brick plaza.
I wondered if you could do the same thing and sort of talk about your design of Pullen Park.
Pullen Park was a wonderful project. In that, they gave me complete control over what I would draw. They just wanted a sensational project. Mm-hmm. And you can't believe what I ended up with, but I ended up with 10 times more design than they ever anticipated doing.
Right.
But from that, you can start picking off pieces. So one of the pieces that I decided to go for was an old armory sitting on the campus. So I happened over there about 10 o'clock on a morning and walked in, and they were shooting. They shot in the armory. It had 12-inch concrete walls. And I said to the sergeant, I said, could I speak to you a minute? He said, yes. So I said, how are chances for us to end up, we're designing a massive park through here, and it would really help us if we could get your building for a theater in the park. He said, well, you couldn't have come at a more opportune time. He said, we have to give up this facility. It's too dangerous in this area. Mm-hmm. He sent us stray around, you know, might hit some of the kids or whatever. So anyway, they put it before their army group, and by God, we got the building. They gave us the building. And we made it, and, you know, they made it into a theater in the park. I say they, it was nationally owned by the city. But I'm trying to point to you in a way in this talk that many of the projects were not designs approved by the government.
Right.
They were things that I worked out as I went along with the master planning of these universities and colleges and parks. And so forth. And it became a very big part of my practice. I would go as much as two or three blocks in any direction and find out what was going to happen to that property. And then if I could work it into my design, I would do it.
Right. So, I mean, context was a really big part of why you're
doing it. That's what they did in Europe. They didn't just look at the little place for their building. They looked at the whole damn group.
Right. I wondered if you could also talk a little bit about the same sort of thing with the amphitheater at Meredith.
Beautiful example again. I was in my wildest period then. I was winning on all fronts. 1975 was the Brickyard, 1975 was Pullen Park, and 1975 was the amphitheater. The president Meredith College called me and said, Dick, how about coming out here? And give me some ideas what to do with this swamp I got. Said, the girl's afraid of it. Snakes crawl out of it and all this sort of thing. And we just need some ideas what to do with it, whether we need to cut out all the trees, cut out all the swamp.
Right.
Clean up the snakes, mow it, plant it in grass, and mow it. So anyway, I looked at it, and I thought to myself, well, we got springs coming out of this hill. I mean, this was obvious. We had a good flow of water, which in my checking, I found out that it flowed all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, a lake is obviously the best thing. We had three sides of the lake built, and so all we had to do was build a dam on the lower end. And so I went to him and said, why don't we use that bulldozer that the Army gave you? The Army had given all the presidents of small colleges a bulldozer, if you can believe this, after World War II. And they were pushing, scratching around on the Earth's surface. And I said, give me that bulldozer and I'll go out there and build you a dam. I've checked it out with the, I believe it was the agriculturist I was dealing with to help me design the dam. And so I wanted to put in a circular dam. So they said, well, we never built a circular dam. You have to build it straight. I said, no. I said, actually, it would be stronger if it was a rounding form and it would reinforce itself. So they said, okay, you go build your dam. So I did. And we even dammed around some trees in the middle of it, around the sides. And it came about. The water was wonderful. It stayed full all the time. It's just been a scenic masterpiece. And they used it for May Days, and then they started getting high schools in there for the graduation, and they used it for their own graduations.
Right.
And then they got the symphony orchestra from North Carolina Symphony to go out there for 4 or 5 years.
Right.
And do great July the 4th concerts. But they carried, finally beat them on that. They finally created their own stuff and they went out to carry.
So what other of your creations have really stood out for you as especially significant?
Well, certainly Moore Square Transit Block was an amazing facility to me in that the city started out with a $2.5 million transportation distribution center. And they also wanted to build a deck in the area for about 200 cars. And I went in and did 2 master plans for that area. I was the master planner on the project, working with the engineers. I have to remember that. Wilbur Smith and Associates were the engineers. And the architect was Terry Alford. Now he's been deceased for a long time. Wonderful guys. And we decided that deck was not right. And so we designed 900 car parking deck and paralleled it with the system of bus distribution.
Right.
And brought back the whole block. We saved all the buildings. We didn't bulldoze down any buildings. And then that whole block came back, which was the nucleus of really a lot of major improvements in downtown Raleigh.
Right. Well, you've had a big impact on sort of the built environment of North Carolina over the past half century, and particularly in Raleigh, and you've also been sort of outspoken in some of your frustrations you've encountered, and I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about some of those.
Well, I think North Carolina has always been a very depressed state. I think much of that depression comes from having been so poor. They certainly furnished a lot of men in the Civil War, in fact more than any other state. But this is a result, and even then in the Civil War they couldn't decide whether they wanted to be on one side or the other, so a lot of our people were fighting for the Union and the others for the Confederacy.
Right.
But we always said we were born in a valley valley of
humility
between two mountains of deceit, that being Virginia and South Carolina.
Right.
And so I think that sort of idea pervaded the mountaineers and where I was on the coast. And really, it was after World War II that I think we started pulling things together and getting beyond rail transportation and water transportation and opening up with a lot of highways and roads. We were the road-building state
right. In
the 48 all along in there. Had more of them than anybody else. Still do.
Elsewhere, you've sort of spoken about the cowboy mentality of today's developers. I wondered if you could talk about what that is and what sort of impact that's having.
Well, I am not very fond of what has been happening because primarily my 30 years after I graduated was bent on teaching people to save trees and save the water resources and save land. And in fact, save the scenic glories of our state. We were just champions in that too, with all our state park systems. In the 80s, with the invention of the computer and a computer edge to looking at landforms ceased to exist. I mean, they became an engineering function, they became a surveyor's function, they became a rape and scrape operation.
Okay.
Because it was easier to tell a computer, you know, put a 2% grade on this land and destroy 95% of it. That's what you're allowed to destroy and save 5%.
Right.
And if that 5% lives, all the better. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. And then the fines, when never was any fines in place to stop anybody from cutting anything anymore.
Right.
So you develop this bulldozer mentality. There's no better way to describe it than what we've been operating under for the last 25 years since 1980.
Right.
And the computer is in the hands of people as they come up the ladder out of NC State and other places. I mean, you can't say that we're immune. We created the mess. And we have gotten the human touch for land out of it. It's now a computer operation. Everything's a computer operation.
Okay.
And once you remove man's feeling for the land or man's feeling for the resources above and below the land and for the sky and for the oceans and rivers and creeks that feed everything, then you get into a real mess because you have no value system based on genesis anymore. You have nothing. You flatten everything. And this is the cowboy mentality that we saw out west. Except they didn't have as much as we have in this state in the way of natural resources.
Right.
And it's much easier to do it in the desert.
Right.
A place like that, run your rails. But it's a tragedy, and I don't know how to get around it. I hope I will. I'm writing 3 books to that effect. I'm trying to say that ones of us who are lucky enough to be raised in a sensitive natural environment of a natural part of the state, and we were able to go to a great university at the time, NC State, and get what we needed to win Rome prizes and go to Europe and study the great projects in Europe and Asia. We're damn lucky.
Right. Was there anything else you wanted to add, or about either your career or sort of your impact or anything like that?
Well, we haven't talked about my wife, but I would have to say that my wife has been all that she should have been and more. She developed a great regional art gallery. We had 3 children. 2 of them graduated from the School of Design. A daughter in landscape architecture and a son in product design. And they chose not to practice. My daughter practices, but my son doesn't.
Okay.
It's been a marvelous profession for myself, but I still say that we have to be the people, the profession that really stands out to protect our environment. I mean, you can't have a bunch of people who are chopping it to shreds saying we want to protect the environment.
Right.
I mean, we want $500 to save that one tree out there in the middle of the swamp. No, it will come slowly. We do everything slowly in North Carolina, but I saw a major tourist industry started on the Outer Banks with the Lost Colony. I know how my father worked and all the people around him and the Carolina Playmakers and and Andy Griffith. See, Andy's just a little older than I am. I knew him quite well on the island.
You knew Andy Griffith well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And all these guys in the 50s came along.
Right. And, well, I guess he lives in Manio, too, right? He lives in Manio.
Yes,
I guess.
He does.
Okay. Right. And you mentioned 3 books you're writing currently. What are those?
They're going to be basically on my father immigrating from England and my mother, German extraction, and how they created in us the feeling, the wanting of opportunities to spread our wings.
All right. Well, I appreciate your taking the time to do this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chad.